This morning, I have the responsibility to inform friends, co-workers, and the public of those who lost their lives yesterday. All but one of the 12 victims were employees of the city of Virginia Beach. I have worked with most of them for many years. We want you to know who they were, so in the days and weeks to come, you will learn what they meant to all of us, to their families, to their friends, and to their co-workers.
Here to discuss the shooting in Virginia Beach on Friday is John Lott. He's the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and the author of The War on Guns. John, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks. I mean, I wish it was under better circumstances, as usual.
Of course. The shooter seemed pretty quote-unquote normal. His supervisor said no red flags. His neighbor said, yeah, he was a normal guy. He was kind of kept to himself, but if you spoke to him, he would speak to you, and they didn't see anything abnormal about the guy or think that there was anything weird about him, which we often hear afterwards. Did you see anything different about this shooting compared to others?
Well, there are many things that are similar. Look, I think it's very hard for even mental health care experts to identify these people as having problems beforehand. Many of these things that we see or people talk about after one of these attacks are like Monday morning quarterbacking, things that people would have thought were unusual only once they see that there's been an attack. In this case, it's even, you know, more difficult than that. People aren't even seeing things even after the attack there. But, you know, I think... there's, given how hard it is to identify these individuals beforehand, I think more emphasis has to be on what do you do when you can't identify these individuals? What types of policies do we have that will work to stop them when we can't identify them beforehand?
You know, John, this guy was a legal gun owner, according to the government. The two weapons he had purchased legally. And of course, there's an instant public policy debate where you have various Democratic candidates, regardless of the details, calling for gun control. Do you have a sense? What is the statistic of among legal gun owners? What percentage of legal gun owners never commit a crime with the gun?
One of the most bizarre things is like literally within 2 hours or so, you had almost all the Democratic presidential candidates go and make policy statements about things that we need to go and do afterwards. It turns out none of their proposals would have had anything at all to go and do with stopping these attacks. Background checks. Obviously, this person had passed background checks, apparently even a federal one for the suppressor that was there.
So, but again, I just want to repeat the question.
Right.
What percentage of legal gun owners never commit a crime?
I mean, it's like essentially zero. I mean, you have, just take the number of crimes. You have something like 150 million Americans that legally own guns.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're talking about, you know, even if you look at the number of crimes they're committed with guns each year and assume all those have been, you know, legally owned guns, which aren't, you're talking about a few hundred thousand. So, I mean, even if all those were legal gun owners to begin with, that would be a tiny fraction even of that. Of course, that's not true. I mean, the number of people, for example, people commit murder. About 90% of people commit murder are people that already have violent criminal histories. So they're not legal gun owners most likely to begin with.
Yeah, and my point, of course, is that legal gun owners would be the ones that would be hit by the overwhelming majority of gun owners. Use the guns appropriately, and they'd be affected by all these public policy changes.
Yeah, exactly. So you go and you put regulations that make it difficult for law-abiding citizens. Look, in this case, it was illegal for any public employee to be able to go and have a gun inside this building. And obviously, there were lots of law-abiding employees there, basically all the ones, but pretty much the only people inside the building. Everybody who was killed inside the building was a public employee. And the person who did this crime, obviously, was the one person who broke the law or the policies there in terms of carrying his gun inside.
You know, John, how do we turn the conversation to the other things that all these people have in common? They're almost always male. They're almost always white males. This man happened to not be a white male, but they're almost always white males. There's obviously some history of some kind of mental illness there, whether it's diagnosed or undiagnosed. How do we turn the conversation to look at the cause instead of the symptom?
Okay, well, I'm not sure if you're saying the cause is white maleness.
No, I'm not saying that's the cause, but I'm saying there are other things. You know, if you only want to go after, oh, it's a death by a gun, we have to ban guns. Well, it's
right.
Death by male, so maybe we should ban men. That, to me, that's the lunacy of their argument.
Right.
There are other things that we can look at the cause of these shootings
sure.
as opposed to the
look,
symptom
wish,
of it.
I wish it was easy to identify people having mental problems to begin with. I mean, you look... Over the last couple decades, we've had about half of the mass public shooters were actually seeing mental health care experts prior to their attacks. And yet, within a year of their attacks, and yet not one single case were those mental health care experts identifying these individuals as a danger to themselves or others. You know, I wish... obviously, I mean, these are psychiatrists and psychologists. I mean, there's a whole academic literature out there about how difficult it is for mental health care experts to identify people as a danger to themselves or others.
Well, John, I want, if we can, I'd like to hold you for another segment here because
sure.
I want to ask you about the use of a suppressor in this firefight. The gunman had a suppressor on one of the .45 caliber pistols. There is now obviously a public policy debate around that device, and I want actual details about how that works with a guy who understands them, John Lott, in a moment. 6:44 here on WWE.
If he had not had a silencer, that gun would have made a ferocious noise, and you have to ask yourself, would the police have come right then? Then secondly, when he goes into the building, many of the victims have said they didn't realize it was gunshots because it didn't sound like them. Or those who thought they were gunshots thought they were much further away. That's because of the sound muffling quality of a silencer. Now, they're legal to own if you get them registered.
And do you have to go through the same process to buy a silencer as
no.
you do to buy a handgun?
No, it's stricter. Mm-hmm. The gun, it's an instant check at the gun store.
Right.
Here you have to fill out a form, submit identification, fingerprints. You mail it into the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They review it, and you get a back approval or
and
not.
And he got this legally?
It takes months. We don't know whether he
okay.
got the silencer, whether he went through the what's called the registration process for it.
All right, that was Pete Williams on NBC explaining on Meet the Press. See, that the shooter here had two .45 caliber pistols. One of them was equipped with a suppressor. We're talking right now with John Lott. He's the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and author of The War on Guns. John, first of all, did Pete Williams get the technical and the legal side of the suppressors correct? And what else should we know about suppressors?
Yeah, I mean, on the process of getting it, you're talking about at least a 9-month wait in practice for going and getting these devices. On the how they operate part, I would just say, you know, you know a gun's been fired, even with a suppressor. I mean, I guess people watch too many movies and they think that it actually makes the shot very silent. It just makes it not as loud as it was before. You'll definitely hear it. You'll know that it's a gun. And in fact, the police officers found this individual's position inside the building. As soon as they entered, they could hear shots going off, and they went there. You know, it's very hard to hear shots outside of most buildings. The police, maybe the police were outside walking around and they could have heard shots. I kind of doubt it. Sounds like they were inside the building when they came. There's, I guess, only one shot fired outside beforehand at one individual that was there. And the parking lot was apparently empty. So it's not really clear to me that even if the shot had been louder, anybody would have heard it there. So, there's a lot of ifs there in Pete Williams' statement that I think makes it sound more likely that there would have been a different outcome than there was.
John, it sounds as if, from what we understand, he did everything by the book. And listen, the system failed, but you can only control so much. How many people actually own suppressors? Is this an item that is owned by a lot of people across the country?
I can't remember exactly. You're talking about maybe a million or so.
Okay, so in the big scheme of things, it's not a lot of people.
No, it's just a tiny fraction of people who own guns. Own this. I mean, you essentially have to go through the same type of background check to go and get what they call a stamp to own one of the limited machine guns that are out there. This is not a trivial process to go through and get it.
Right. And so a suppressor, John, these are often used in part to assist sort of the hearing damage that comes with actually firing a gun, right? So a suppressor might be a useful device. Say if you're shooting a lot at a range, you might wear that in either in addition to double hearing protection or whatever in order to sort of bring down some of the audible impact of the gun itself.
Yeah. No, I mean, you'll still notice it. You'll still probably want to wear hearing protection directly on your head too. There's no doubt about that. But yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's one of the things that people do. Just if you're going to fire a lot, you want to protect your hearing.
And it also diminishes the recoil of the weapon?
Really slightly. I mean, only to the extent that it's kind of reducing the air discharge that's there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, it's very slight.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, as usual, the public policy debate revolves around banning it. So, you know, this is where we go. So it's helpful to have some sense of how responsible gun owners actually use the things to begin with.
Well, I mean, they've looked at the rate that people commit crimes with this. I think there's like 1.2 million suppressor licenses out there.
Uh-huh.
And if you look over the last 10 years or so, there have been about 44 cases a year where somebody's been prosecuted who's had a suppressor, who's been prosecuted for a crime, not necessarily a crime that's related to having the suppressor, but prosecuted for some type of crime.
That was commissioned while they had one. Okay. All right, John Lott, thank you. Really appreciate it. The important thing in the wake of all this is always to get the facts, and you brought them. Thanks, John.